Life Audio.
Hey, Dr. Bill Sinyard here with Gospel App Ministries and Gospel Rant Podcast. So welcome to my new series on the book of Hebrews. And Hebrews is a bit of an enigma, really. We're not sure who wrote it or who it was written to, why it was written. I mean, we can make some educated guesses, and we will. So in this podcast, I want to try to unpack what it means for us today and for the larger Christian church today. And I believe that its message is not only very timely, but critical. And probably not what we want to hear, but we need to, and I need to. All right, we'll get right into the book of Hebrews after a brief word from our sponsors. We will be right back.
But look around you, your family, your faith. They're not in the way. They are the way.
From the creators of Jesus Revolution comes the incredible true story.
It's going to be dangerous and scary and giving up. It's not an option.
The story of one family's journey from down under to center stage. Unsung Hero, a For King and Country film starring Candace Cameron Bure and Terry O'Quinn. In theaters now. Visit unsunghero.movie to learn more. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
What impacts you every day? There is one book that influences almost every aspect of our lives. Museum of the Bible reveals the Bible's impact on your favorite musicians and artists, the way we measure time, social justice, our national monuments, and more. The Bible's impact is all around you. Discover how at museumofthebible.org/impact.
All right, let's roll up our sleeves and get going. Background and content first. So author, man, there's been so many possible authors proposed. We can be pretty sure that the author is male. In 11 verse 32, he writes, "For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, and so on." The "me to tell" is middle masculine participle, so that narrows the field down to about half the population of males. So let the speculation begin. Historically, many have proposed Paul, but, you know, it's just not likely. I mean, first, if you just did a blind test with five Greek graduate students and give them a huge portion of one of Paul's letters, blind, right, and then a large portion of Hebrews, it would be unanimous that they weren't written by the same hand. Paul's letters are epistles, you know, grace and peace to you. Hebrews is a sermon, it's a homily, it's a rhetorical masterpiece made to be read aloud. It's got poetic structural devices such as chiasms and alliteration everywhere. Paul, you know, he's known for run-on sentences and ina clauses, you know, the in order that, just on after on after on. In Athens, the Greek philosophical elites called Paul a seed picker, kind of a dumb bird who's just kind of bouncing around the ground picking at seeds, right? Hebrews, it's just not likely it's written by Paul. Second reason is the author of Hebrews calls Timothy his brother in the faith. That's 13:23. Paul refers to Timothy as his son, 1 Corinthians 4:17. Third reason, the author of Hebrews says that he received the gospel from the apostles, those who followed Jesus. Well, Paul claims to have heard directly from Jesus. Fourth reason, Paul often quotes the Hebrew Old Testament, while the author of Hebrews quotes the Greek, the Alexandrian translation of the Septuagint. Fifth reason, there are 154 words in Hebrews that are not found anywhere else in the New Testament, including the letters of Paul. The author uses some common Pauline words very rarely, like righteousness or agape, only twice in Hebrews versus 65 times in the letters of Paul. Spirit, very carefully. Spiritual fruits and gifts. The flesh, sarx, baptism, submission, hupotasso, and even faith. The author of Hebrews emphasizes faithfulness, meaning loyalty to God and the calling. Jesus' exaltation and being made better is emphasized more than his death in Hebrews. The use of Old Testament is primarily related to the tabernacle and in particular the Day of Atonement, which Paul doesn't talk about very much. So then who could it be? Well, here are a few of the suggestions. Luke, Aquila, Clement of Rome, Apollos. Clement of Rome is probably too late. Of the others, only Apollos is referred to as being Alexandrian, Greek, Jew, highly educated. That's Acts 18:24. So, you know, to me, until somebody has a better idea, I'm going to guess that it's Apollos, but I wouldn't take a bullet for it. So, it's written by a male, highly educated, trained Hellenistic Jewish Christian who is familiar with the apostles and is concerned about a particular situation enough to send a long sermon that he expects to be read aloud. So the audience, who might the audience be? The popular guess is Rome, the Roman church. And I'm going there. It could be Antioch. It could be Alexandria. It could be Jerusalem. It could be Corinth. But I'm liking Rome for this. Hebrews 13:24, greet all your brothers and all the saints, those who come from Italy send you greetings. The implication, though it's not really captured well in the English, is that all of us in Italy send you greetings. So it seems like they're writing from Italy. So why was it written and when? Well, more speculation. Paul's letter to the Romans was written in the late 50s, Common Era, CE. Peter maybe gets to Rome a decade earlier, or half a decade earlier, mid-40s. In 49 CE, the Roman Emperor Claudius expelled all of the Jews from Rome due to disruptions that were being made, and likely by Christian Jews. The reference is they were being led by Crestus, which some people believe was Jesus. They were so worked up about Jesus that they were letting people know it. It was causing quite a disruption in Rome. I like that for this letter. So speculation that the Christians were actively proselytizing and the community was reacting. The single message that there is a God over Caesar. And if you're a Jew in Rome and you're saying that, that's just not going to go well. So it was not beyond them to overreact and use a club instead of a scalpel to remove the irritants. So that is when Priscilla and Aquila were forced to leave Rome. They ended up in Corinth in the maybe early 50s. Priscilla and Aquila became friends of Paul and valued associates, Romans 16:3-4. And in Corinth, they met, here we go, and discipled a man named Apollos. So based on all of that, let me propose a date, such a guess, but in a situation that could have initiated such a letter from the author of Hebrews. So maybe this sermon was composed by Apollos, sometimes after 54, but before the violent persecutions under Nero in the late 50s. So somewhere between 54 and 59 or 60. Paul's epistle was there as well. Aquila and Priscilla would have been in Rome with Apollos, maybe. And they saw the state of the Christian church there that they left, right? The persecution of Nero hasn't yet begun in earnest, so few had died for the faith yet, but they will soon. So the Hebrew themes are perseverance under suffering, and suffering is, you know, it hurts, but it leads to exaltation, and Christ is our example. And we need to access a heaven-born faith that drives loyalty, even in the midst of suffering and persecution. Here's 12:4. In your struggles against sin, and we'll talk about that, in what Hebrews means by sin, you have not resisted to the point of shedding your blood, but you will. So the main point is that the Church of Christ in Rome, only 20 years after Jesus' death and crucifixion, and maybe only 10 years after the church began in Rome, had already begun to drift. And Hebrews 2:1, this is kind of a theme. We must pay more careful attention, therefore, to what we have heard, so that we do not drift away. So he doesn't say so that you don't fall into sin. It's drifting away. Drifting away from what? That's what I'm going to talk about in this particular show. And look, why don't we talk about such drift very much? I was on my denominational church revitalization task force, and I will tell you that the drift is everywhere. It's so real and so subtle, and so it happens so unaware. It's like gravity, and it's not an evil thing. Rather, it's a very human thing. If the drift isn't acknowledged and corrected, soon the young Roman church is not going to be able to survive Nero's persecution. That's the idea. They need to get back to the main thing and fast. All right, let's talk about drift. You've probably heard me talk before about spiritual life cycle. I want to credit my mentor and friend Ken Pretty for this illustration, particularly for churches. It's the church life cycle. So imagine a bell-shaped curve with three sections from left to right, birth and incline to the left, recline at the top of the curve, and decline to the right. It's all around us. People have one, birth, middle age, and decline. Food has another. I mean, look in your refrigerator. My family growing up used lots of casseroles. You know, at birth stage, they were fresh, they were hot, they were tasty. But then, you know, we kept it for the recline stage. It had been in the fridge for a while, looked kind of rugged, and so we covered it with cheese, and that seemed to be okay for three hungry boys. And then decline, well, you can imagine what that looks like, and what would you even eat it? So all institutions have the same cycle. When I was a strategic management consultant in the 80s, we spoke about this to companies that we worked with, major companies, Fortune 500 companies. All organizations and people have life curves. One thing to point out is that the life curve only goes one direction, from birth and incline to decline. You can't just wave your hand and move to the left, right? You have to relaunch in the same way that you began, in some real way. We'll talk about that. So it begins at the far lower left with birth. For churches, this is that magical time when Christians gather together, excited Christians with a shared mission, a lot of commonality, and to reach the community. That's the point with Jesus. And then comes this exciting inclined phase of church growth. So in this incline, think 7 to 10 o'clock if it was a clock phase. It's a time of great miracles, spiritual growth, sacrifice, and by the way, conversions. They prioritize telling their neighbors about Jesus, what he said, what he did, how he did it, his death on the cross, his resurrection, and what all that means and means to us today. Right? In the book of Hebrews terms, they make neighbors hear God's final and most perfect word, Jesus. Everything else is second place, second tier. Churches on the incline major on this. So the life cycle begins with Jesus, 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 and shifts then to programs at the recline and then to our church institution, building, heritage, staff, when we slide into decline. So Jesus, 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 which shifts to programs, which shifts to the institution, the church, the building, the heritage, and the staff. You can see how things change. And it's not just evangelism, meaning message. So as we experience Jesus, his spirit in our inner being, we begin to manifest his innate DNA a little bit, right? His, not ours. And what I mean by that is we become other-oriented during the incline phase, even though it costs us, even though it's sacrificial. And we talk about sacrificial relationships. God's love is always other-directed. And so inclining churches are typically more other-oriented than churches in recline and decline. And by the way, that includes social justice issues, feeding the poor, healing, casting out demons, punishing inequities and injustices, because it's all about Jesus and what he came to do for beat up, underachieving, lonely, unlovable, unloved, misrepresented people. So then the cycle goes from being sacrificially other-oriented to it shifts to being more self-focused, right? So other-oriented, Jesus, 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 to a little more self-focused in recline. Inclining churches tend to also listen to God. So God, this is what some of the leadership meetings sound like. God, what do you want us to do? Where do we go? We're ready to sacrifice our comfort, our cash, our preferences, our reputations for our neighbors. A lot of messiness in the church, a lot of mistakes, and often it's a disaster, but we do it again and again and again. So we hear God say, and then we shift to, you know, we've got these programs, let's just keep them going. So when I started a church plant, and I'm just an example, right, in the mid-90s in Vancouver, Lower Mainland, we first went to the neighborhood and met with educators, city planners, counselors, anyone who would give us some sense of the needs of the people. How could we serve them, right? We don't want to come in and make them look like us, fit them into our mold. We actually wanted to incarnate into their skin. Well, the number one concern we found out was denial. People were saying, we need help, but we're too proud to admit it. Our families, our marriages need help, our education system needs help, but, you know, we're not ready to do anything about it, and kids in particular. So we became the church that loved kids. Whether you come from a religious family or not, we were the church that embraced addicts. The place was loaded with addicts, the divorced, those who had had abortions and felt guilty. And listen, in the end, we had 10 mother tongues represented in our congregation. Can you imagine? We had vacation Bible schools for children that included twice as many children as we had congregants. Unbelievers and believers. We had, in one case, a heroin-addicted daughter of the local First Nations chief. She came to our VBS. She brought her troubled crack cocaine baby. And, you know, much to the dismay of her father, she was welcomed. She was unjudged. The boy thrived, and she had never heard about Jesus, not like we were saying. And look, our drive and focus was on our new friends and neighbors hearing about the real Jesus and their lives getting shaken up and renewed just like we had been. So we went from being very flexible and inclined, and then it shifted to being program and highly structured in recline and decline. Incline churches have very little repeated programming other than worship. Look, if you can organize something that our neighbors will come to and we get to know them and we can talk about Jesus, I mean, graciously, it's fantastic. We don't have to do it again. We don't have to do it next year. So it's very task-oriented, other-oriented. So what happens when persecution comes along for an incline church? Well, incline church is considered a badge of courage. It's kind of expected, right? Jesus was persecuted, so was Paul, Peter, you name it. It seems that if we're doing this right, there's going to be persecution from this fallen world. We had a witch come and curse us. We heard her saying death to the children, and when we confronted her, she ran out the door. And so what did we do? Well, we gathered all the children, we counted them up, and then we went, oh my goodness, we win. Our God is so much bigger. We held hands and thanked God for his love and protection. We weren't stupid, right? I mean, we did have a bit of a bring it on mentality when it came to persecution and the gospel. So at this stage, there was very little chatter about, hey, what about me? What about my family? What about my preferences? The kind of music I like? It was all about the neighbors. You see? That's a church on the incline. It's other-focused. It's visionary. It's obsessed with living Jesus and being filled with his spirit. It's all about the unchurched. It's all about them. That's the incline stage. It's exciting. It's terrifying at the same time. It's messy. It's chaotic. It's creative. I've seen such incline churches in bars, movie theaters, parks, warehouses. I've seen a rap church. See, we're all going to lay our preferences and rights down for the sake of being able to communicate Jesus to our neighbors, making disciples. Missional leaders love that, and they come to that siren call. Ministry capacity booms and is wildly creative. Creativity is ridiculously high. Experience of the pleasures of the calling of God is off the chart. And so forget budgets. If you have an opportunity, pray to God and see if it comes with cash in from somewhere. It's pretty risky, lots of fun, and you make lots of mistakes. I was invited after 3 years to come back to my seminary, to the church planting program, the class, an evening class, and give a lecture on mistakes that church planters make. I filled 2.5 hours of talking, It was a hoot. There was laughter. There were tears. Three people dropped out of the program. It was a special evening. So in the incline phrase, evangelism is done by everyone, not just the professionals, and it's usually pretty personal, intimate. So forget some carefully constructed mantra, some bridge, some four steps. It's intimate. Hey, can I tell you about what Jesus did for me, where he found me, and what I'm learning, and how I've changed? It's less theological and more testimonial. So when Jesus found me, but then he touched me and made me feel loved. Let me tell you what that means and how it affected my relationships. I can't explain it all, but it's so, so, so real. Do you want some of that? Right? People give to inclining churches because it seems like a good investment. There's high growth, there's conversions. The return on investment is obvious as the kingdom grows. And growth is largely through conversion versus transfer growth. Right? So intimate personal testimonies that cost you something, it shifts to more packaged theological evangelistic approach, and then it shifts to the professionals primarily do that. So conversion to transfer, growth to no growth at all, and decline. Let me talk about recline. So we're at 10 o'clock on the curve and entropy happens. Recline, organization happens. It's not bad. It's not evil. It just is. The subtle shift is from being all about them to wait, what about us and our family? And that's only reasonable, right? So shift from Jesus is for them to what about me? I need programs for me. So it's a shift from the chaotic in the incline stage to focus to more organizational, repeatable programs for those in the core congregation. There is also the beginning of a shift from conversion growth to transfer growth. I mean, the stories are going around about people being changed at this church. It's exciting. And so Christians start coming from other churches. So there's a lot of transfer growth. And those people come with needs and preferences. Look, it makes sense. We generally don't want mess and constant change for very long. It's just brain size. So people, even Christians, have a tendency towards self. Augustine referred to it as curvatus in se, the self turned in upon itself. No judgment, me too. So in recline, the congregation begins to push for some of their own preferences to be considered too. And it is reasonable, right? You know, what about our family? Shouldn't we have a youth group? What about worship and music and the like? So there's a subtle shift, not evil, very human, to inward. I mean, again, no judgment. It just makes sense to me. Me too. Hey, it's a good time as any to take a break for another word from our sponsors. When we get back, we'll get back to the church life cycle. See you in a moment.
What impacts you every day? There is one book that influences almost every aspect of our lives. Museum of the Bible reveals the Bible's impact on your favorite musicians and artists, the way we measure time, social justice, our national monuments, and more. The Bible's impact is all around you. Discover how at museumofthebible.org/impact.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
So we're in recline around 10 to 2, the peak of the curve per Ken Pretty. Recline is the life cycle stage when the church's ministry capacity levels off, as the church does more or less the same ministry year after year at the same levels of quality and quantity. You have programs. So you organize a staff, you set time for worship, a style of worship, how many times a month we do communion, how we do communion. We set up an office, a place to worship every week. We agree upon a budget and begin to guard the budgeted items. So we have less flexibility to try to do something that God may throw in our way just out of the blue, because we ask, is it in the budget? And that becomes a guiding principle. We focus more on satisfying the needs and desires of those who have come and less on the needs and desires of those who haven't come, them, right? Budgets maximize as the church grows, programs and staff become well-funded, annual meetings, at least at the beginning of Recline, are a lot of fun, and the vision statement on the website refers to the Great Commission, but you know what? It's evident less in the community, to tell you the truth. It's a good church. It's an enviable church. People come. It's a successful, comfortable church. The professional pastors are crazy busy and will tend to burn out, but their week is kind of repetitious and even cyclical, Sunday to Sunday, right? And more time with the members of the congregation, regular order, subtle shifts from, you know, we're experiencing the height and width and length and depth of the love of Christ right now towards more of a functional view of Christianity, less focus on experiencing Jesus personally and more about knowledge of Jesus. And both are good. Transfer growth begins to outpace conversion. The church is less messy, to be sure. The congregation more and more relies on the professional staff to do witnessing and evangelism. People have a testimony, but it's usually about something that happened in the distant past. It's a memory, right? Instead of what God is doing right now, today, and tomorrow. Members are encouraged to give, to be providers, to keep the programs going. Programs are good. You need to keep giving. So tithing. If you don't provide, we can't have a youth pastor, right? Annual meetings become a little more business-like, and the message subtly is immersed in guilt. We got to keep this going. We made commitments. This is what we do. And now budgets rule, right? So what happens when a reclining church is persecuted? Well, it needs to be managed, right? It's no longer a badge of courage. It's a disruption that has to be managed. In consulting, we call this minimizing contingencies, meaning no one likes surprises. So some will leave. Towards the end of Recline and the beginning of Decline, there is a growth of internal dissatisfaction and bickering. I've never seen this fail. Toxic silos pop up. Silos are small groups of people in your church who are tight-knit and share common identities based upon a shared value or preferences, maybe a shared enemy, shared desires for certain practices or rules that will fix the problem, however they see the problem, at least in their toxic view of things. They typically have a lightning rod individual who implicitly demands loyalty from their group and their interest. So the loyalty is absolute and a priority. It's us versus them kind of mentality. And they speak to the current church leadership as, you know, I speak for many people, that kind of thing, right? And if you're not for us, you are against us. I can tell you story after story. That gets us into decline stage, 2 o'clock and beyond. Per pretty, decline is the life cycle stage when the church's ministry capacity just decreases. Less and less ministry is done year after year with execution, more and more compromised, yielding both a qualitative and quantitative loss. So in decline, the me-focused shift becomes even more dramatic. Now our people are thinking more about ourselves because the church is shrinking. So there's anxiety, there's finger pointing, there's silos. We aren't looking at the present or the future. We're going back and remembering the great times of the past. We tell the stories and now we kind of sense we can never go back to the glory days. We're stuck with an expensive staff and structure, and we've lost the people to fund them. We wonder about what God thinks of us. Is he disappointed? Should we be ashamed of ourselves? Is it our fault? Creative missional leaders leave. They don't want any part of this. Annual meetings become more or less guilt and shame fest, murdering people. Fear and anxiety increases. And now You have to survive, so you cut things back so you can lengthen the runway before you have to turn off the lights. Negative growth, meaning you shrink. A little talk about experiencing the love of Jesus anymore. We haven't felt him for a long time. Persecution. Why would there be persecution for such a church? Right? So it's not very pretty, to be sure. Well, here's the thing about life cycle curves. It's driven by deeply rooted human nature and only goes one direction, to the right. This is that drift that Hebrews is talking about. Conversion growth shifts to transfer growth and negative growth. Other orientation to us orientation. So experience of the love of Jesus for the unlovable and the undesirable shifts to doing righteousness according to our statement of theology and belief. Sacrificial visionary shifts to programs and structures and budget orientation. Spirit-filled, messy, chaotic, and shifts to organized and highly structured, tightly run. Expectation that the gospel is powerful enough to reconcile anyone to God and each other shifts to, let's keep the programs going. Expectancy of persecution, the badge of courage feel, shifts to avoid persecution. So how can the drift be stopped and reverted? Book of Hebrews. Therefore, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, right? So we must obsess, prioritize. That's the sense here. OCD over Jesus. Jesus himself, the person of Jesus, lest we drift away from it. Hebrews 2:1. We relaunch. We have Jesus say to us, Lazarus, come forth. We repent of our normal drift that has caused and what it has caused, and we relaunch. Though many will object, we intentionally do the things that we did at the first beginning. Again, an incline. We start by intentionally obsessing over Jesus, what he said, what he did, how he said it, who he spoke it to, who he didn't speak it to, how their lives were changed. And the Holy Spirit in us reignites incline, and miracles happen over and over again. It's exciting, right? So, if I'm right, it only took less than 10 years for the church in Rome to drift, to recline and decline. With persecution coming, they're now highly vulnerable, exposed. They perhaps have survived the expulsion of Claudius, and maybe they're reconsidering, you know, why do we go all in like that? It got us beat up. Some people are in jail. Maybe we lost some revenue. And maybe they've decided not to rock the boat. They're looking at their Jewish brothers and sisters and going, you know, maybe we just need to go back. The Jews aren't proselytizing. It's just not their thing. Well, the author of Hebrews is arguing that they get their original heaven-born faith that causes them to want to be and do Jesus in their fallen world, even though it's going to cost them. And their well-being. It might even cost their careers, their finances, and comfort, and health. It's a miracle, of course, and without it, there is no fresh incline. Just saying. So just for fun, consider we're on the life cycle curve. Your church may be, your organization. And no judgment. Drift happens. And let me know. I'd love to hear stories. Bill@gospel-app.com. If you want me to come and talk to your church about this, send me a line. Next time, we're going to dig a little more into the first section, chapter 1, and I would love to get your feedback on this. I also have a couple of books that should be published soon. The Unlikely Prince is in the same genre as C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. It's written for 10 to 14-year-olds. Great, great story, powerful, important gospel presentation just beneath the story. C.S. Lewis supposedly said that if he had to do it all over again, he would write more children's books. And the reason why is because adults read them. And The Unlikely Prince is that. It's also for adults. The message is very powerful. The idea is that not all quests are the same. And then I have a series of books, Dance Daughters to the Most High, about overlooked and underappreciated women in the Old Testament and New Testament. It's fun, read, it's encouraging, it's informative, great for women's Bible studies, book clubs. These are the heroines of our faith that have been overlooked. We need to hear their story. Send me a note, bill@gospel-app.com, to find out when they're coming out. You can also follow me on Instagram, Gospel App, one word, And on YouTube, Dr. Bill Sinyard, you can find a video of this particular message and so much more. And please subscribe while you're there. That helps us more than you can imagine. We'll see you next time. Take heart, child of God.
I found myself on a ledge, three stories high at some condominiums, contemplating my life and struggling to understand my purpose. Have you ever found yourself on a ledge? My name is Billy Yant. I'm a caring father, mentor, and friend. In my new podcast, Billy and the Goat, I share the life-changing events that shaped who I am today to remind you that no matter how far you've fallen, God can help you get up and thrive. Listen now at lifeaudio.com.